You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of August 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
This is a proof of his ignorance and arrogance. And I again and again ask his advisors to get him in a room, close the door, and set him right.
Having successfully alienated women, black people, gay people, Latinos and Muslims, among many, many others, Donald Trump starts on the families of dead soldiers. When, if ever, will enough Republicans decide that enough is indeed enough? My guests Quentin Peel and Michael Goldfarb will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including France's ongoing search for a constructive response to Islamist terror, the degree to which participating in the Rio Olympics will be a health hazard, and Tajikistan's crackdown on incomprehensible journalists, whoever can they mean. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests on Midori House today are Quentin Peel, Associate Fellow at Chatham House and contributor to the Financial Times, and Michael Goldfarb, journalist, author and broadcaster. Welcome both. And we will start tonight with the presidential election campaign of Donald Trump, who shows no sign of heeding any advice he might have received to cease, having sealed the Republican nomination, behaving like a three-year-old arbitrarily denied pudding. So far this week, he has derided the parents of a fallen veteran, insisted that Russia wouldn't invade Ukraine, it has, called Hillary Clinton the devil and suggested that November's election might be rigged. And it's only Tuesday. Let's hear how Trump versus Khan has started to divide the nation.
You're asking Americans to trust you with their future. Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution?
I saw him. He was very emotional. And if you look at his wife, she was standing there. She had nothing to say. She probably, maybe she wasn't allowed.
I can say that my religion or my family or my culture never stopped me saying whatever I want to say.
When you have radical Islamic terrorists probably all over the place, we're allowing them to come in by the thousands and thousands. And I think that's what bothered Mr. Khan more than anything else.
This is a proof of his ignorance and arrogance. And I again and again ask his advisors to get him in a room, close the door, and set him right.
My name is Catherine, and I am a military mom. Time and time again, Trump has disrespected our nation's armed forces and veterans, and his disrespect for Mr. Khan and his family is just an example of that.
Trump versus Khan there, or Trump versus everybody, really, as the campaign rolls on. And just as we go to air, reports reach us from Ashburn, Virginia, that Trump has asked a woman with a crying baby to leave his rally. Presumably, he thought two crying babies at a rally was one too many. Michael Goldfarb, first of all, I don't even know where to start at this point. Have we ever seen anything remotely like this in American politics?
No, never. And hopefully we won't ever see it again after November. My latest project is I'm writing a five-part series for a different radio network, we won't name it, called All My Presidents. And it's a history of the 11 presidents of my lifetime and how presidents affect people socially and culturally much more than they do through their legislative programs because they don't always get what they want through Congress. And I was writing about Dwight David Eisenhower, Republican president of the 1950s, and rereading his farewell address to the nation.
This is the famous military-industrial complex speech.
The famous, and not only that, the educational-industrial complex is included as well, warning against what happens when everybody's trying to get government contracts to do scientific research. It will actually hurt free thinking. To read that language, to realize that he was the president twice. This was the Republican Party that I grew up in as a boy. And I'm, by the way, I come from a family of Democrats, so it's not like I'm a Republican. To read that language and to consider the man who delivered it, this is the man who organized the landings on D-Day, And then to look at Donald Trump is, in one simple, not so simple, moment to understand just how far American society has fallen over the course of my lifetime. It is extremely unhappy. The only thing that seems to be slightly bright today, and it's raining in London, is that we're beginning to get a better polling picture now that both conventions have happened. And it does seem that more and more people are beginning to understand that Donald Trump is more than a joke. He's a danger.
It does appear to be a strange. You mentioned, you know, eyes. When you start talking about Eisenhower versus Trump, it is the descent from, I guess, Caesar to Nero, possibly even Caligula, echoed all over again. Quentin, possible story in the wind today. Richard Hanna, Republican congressman from New York, has actually become the first GOP member of Congress to endorse Hillary Clinton today. There's been a few senators, including Lindsey Graham and Jeff Flake, who've said they won't vote for Trump. Will Richard Hanna be the last? Have we reached the point at which serious Republicans, people like Paul Ryan, people like Mitch McConnell, are going to start feeling seriously pressured to walk away from this?
I don't think we have reached that point yet. I think they're going to still try and close ranks somehow and just see how it plays. Because I fear, and I've been like all of us through the painful recent experience of the British referendum campaign, that there is something out there that is very strong that Donald Trump is tapping into, a real resentment of the political elite. And the trouble is that the more he can present himself as the vilified outsider, which of course he isn't, he's an insider, but if he can make himself out to be the man who is in revolt against the establishment, he gets away with it. And the more he attracts attention as being an in-your-face, rude, shock jock sort of type, that's going to appeal to some people.
This is the worry, that people are attracted to him, not despite the fact that he's an ignorant, obnoxious Yahoo, but because he's an ignorant, obnoxious Yahoo.
Absolutely. And if he can keep the focus on certain rather unpleasant prejudices, like prejudice against immigrants, prejudice against Muslims, he is actually winning, even if what he's saying is really deeply shocking and usually untrue.
Michael, what do you think? Because we saw yesterday Senator John McCain, who is more entitled than most people to take umbrage with disrespect to people who've served their country, issued a fairly unmitigated rebuke to Donald Trump, but still stopped short of actually disendorsing him. Why have we not reach that point yet?
I don't know. I mean, I think they're trying to triangulate their way to a position. The fact is that Donald Trump won the primary process. There's no getting away from that. If you disregard, and when he makes claims about bringing new people into voting in the Republican primary, it's one of the few claims he makes that's actually true. Now, how, if you're a prominent Republican, do you repudiate the votes of the people who bought into Donald Trump? I don't know how you do it. I mean, going back to what Quentin's just said, I mean, since the Brexit vote, you find people all over trying to figure out a way to have, let's have a rerun, let's have a do-over. And, there's stories today about farmers are finally, how did they not know this? They get the checks almost every quarter. You know, these vast, and they are vast. I have visited a friend once in Yorkshire, and he had inadvertently left his post from the previous day on the table. I said, is that what you get for growing crops from the Common Agricultural Policy? He said, yes. I said, that's it. You're paying for the drinks tonight. I mean, and yet they're just finally figuring it out. Now, I don't think that that's the case in America. In America, they have to go. And the problem with John McCain, because you pick him out, Andrew, is that John McCain has nothing more to fight for. He's in his mid-70s. He has no money worries. He has only his reputation and history to be concerned about. Now, this is a man who became a Republican front runner by saying, you know, I don't like John McCain. He was a prisoner of war. I like guys who weren't captured, as if he was a loser for being shot down over North Vietnam and surviving 5 years in a prison camp and being tortured quite brutally.
In contrast to Donald Trump, who actually managed to keep getting deferment for rather spurious reasons.
Bone spurs, in fact, to make the pun. You know, now, it's for John McCain to decide, look, I'm not going to go any further in my political career. I'm a Republican. I come from a family of Republicans. This is a disgrace. I will not support him. And I think people will be pressing him to do that. But on the other hand, he's got to consider all the people who voted for Trump and who will probably vote for him again come November.
Final thought on this from you, Quentin. Barack Obama, President Obama, has spoken within the last hour, making clear the delineation that where he may have disagreed with Mitt Romney and John McCain on matters of policy, he did not think either of them actually incapable of acquitting the office of president. He has actually said that in a speech this evening. He thinks that Donald Trump is actually just completely, fundamentally unfit for the office. There have been serious concerns started to be raised in recent weeks as Trump's behaviour grows ever stranger about whether there is actually a problem here. Is that something that needs to be addressed seriously?
I think it does. I mean, I think it's a very real question. It is a really scary world that we would be in, I think, if you had somebody who acts as he speaks. Now, we don't know yet, but he's not got a very impressive business record, actually. And that was a point that Warren Buffett has put his finger on, say, this guy does not impress me as a businessman either. The trouble is he's a rogue and a rebel, and I think people out there, quite a lot of people, are feeling very angry ever since the financial crisis, the collapse. And they're pretty cross.
Well, I suspect we will have ample further opportunity to discuss this, so we will move on for the moment. Earlier today, thousands gathered at Rouen Cathedral for the funeral of Father Jacques Hamel, the 85-year-old priest murdered in his Normandy church last week by a pair of self-styled jihadis claiming allegiance to Islamic State. This was the latest, although it has to be suspected not the last, in a series of terror attacks in France, which have put authorities under increasing pressure to do something. Prime Minister Manuel Valls has spoken out loud about suspending foreign funding of mosques and insisting that imams be hitherto trained in France. Michael, are either of those suggestions especially outrageous?
Well, I'm not quite sure what Manuel Valls is on about, because going back to the time of the revolution, the minority religions of France have had to organize themselves and report back to the state. It's not the first time, of course, that France has got in. The French government has got involved with trying to curtail in the public space the full expression, particularly of the Muslim faith. You know, laïcité is their cry, and you know, you've had attempts to, you know, ban hijab in public places or the full niqab, all of that. I don't know that there's anything that can be done. I mean, you could say, well, look, we don't want any more, you know, Saudi-funded mosques being built, but you know, the kids who are being radicalized are being radicalized mostly through the web. They're being radicalized, some of them, in prison, where, you know, Islamist gangs have kind of taken over in a lot of French prisons. And, you know, he's grasping at straws. The interesting thing, of course, is that I don't know if this is what actually happened, but just before I came into the studio, the last report I saw was that François Hollande was not going to Rouen today for this event because of what happened to Manuel Valls when he turned up in Nice a couple of weeks ago.
And I mean, was roundly booed.
Yeah, they don't need the embarrassment. I mean, the socialists are about to lose the presidency anyway next year, and they just don't need the embarrassment. I'm not sure there's anything that the government can do except provide better and quieter security behind the scenes.
Quentin, Michael makes a perfectly reasonable point that the internet does appear to be a primary driver of radicalization. That being the case, are these and other suggestions being floated in France, that thing governments often get into of something must be done, this is something, therefore we must do it?
I fear so, yes. I mean, this is not the first time Manuel Valls has talked about this. He actually raised it for the first time after the attack on the Charlie Hebdo satirical magazine, and he's made no progress with the idea of trying to stop foreign financing. And actually, it seems pretty counterintuitive. There is a problem. There's a lot of pretty hardline Saudi money all over Europe financing building mosques. But actually, I think there's still probably less fewer mosques available for the community, for instance, in France, than there are Christian churches. So they want to have an indigenous, homegrown Islam, if you like, in France. And I don't think that the state cannot interfere. Actually, that's the religion of France, that state and religion are separate, both ways. Religion can't interfere in the state, and state can't interfere in religion.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, they had a thing, and they also had this in the Netherlands as well, of, you know, the imams had to prove proficiency in the language, French, Dutch, and there was some attempt to try and get them to preach their sermons in the native tongue as well. And again, this is an old thing. I mean, going back to, you know, the early 19th century, in order to get essentially licensed in the rights of citizenship in the Jewish community, the rabbis had to prove that they could speak French, because they didn't want some kind of, you know, secret communication going on in a house of worship. I mean, you could go to your house of worship, but we need to know what's being said there. I don't know what happens now. And I don't know what why I focus on Saudi money. My memory is from my last trip to Sarajevo is that just after the war, the Saudis piled in and built a couple of enormous mosques in areas that had been, you know, heavily bombed during the siege of Sarajevo. And good friend of mine, who is senior manager now at the largest daily in Bosnia, and he's a practicing Muslim, says, nobody goes to this mosque anymore. Nobody ever went. Is this a big building that's empty on a Friday? Because we all go to the old local, our locals, from pre-war times, you know, because that's where our friends are. That's what our neighborhood is. So I'm not sure how much there is to fear. What is to be feared is the Wahhabi preaching coming over the internet, being slipped on a CD, you know, in a religious bookshop to some vulnerable young man. And that, I fear, is nothing that you can just ban.
Just a final thought on this one, Quentin. Is the problem that the more governments attempt to crack down on this kind of thing, however well-intentioned or however frightened or desperate they are, and indeed former President Nicolas Sarkozy has suggested that all people on watch lists should just be placed under house arrest or effectively interned without charge, that just drives radicalization further, doesn't it?
I think it probably does. I think we just have to make an enormous effort at the far, far more difficult task of integration, education, incorporation, really to try and get these young Muslims who are, I mean, look at these kids, they're 17, 19, to get them to feel that actually they've got a stake in our society too, and they're not complete outsiders. But that is a very long-term task, and it doesn't win votes in presidential elections.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Quentin Peel and Michael Goldfarb. Coming up next, how fast can you run while holding your breath?
Do you live in the best city in the world? Find out how your metropolis ranks in Monocle's annual rundown of the perfect places to call home in our plump double July-August issue. It's a magazine that tours the globe to find the people and places benchmarking the best in quality of life. And this year, there's a special focus on life, business, and fun after sunset. Here's what our quality surveyors have found for you.
In design, we take a nighttime dip in some of the world's best swimming pools from Reykjavik to Sydney. We take a tour of an old Olympic village now reborn, and we pick the best bits of urban branding from around the world.
In the edits pages, we survey the best after-hours joints for a slice of the good life in Sydney, a diner meal in Auckland, or something to eat in Echo Park in LA, plus ramen in Tokyo.
Monocle's double July-August issue is on newsstands now. Or guarantee your copy by joining us as a Monocle subscriber. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Quentin Peel and Michael Goldfarb. Now, it's a little over 72 hours until the flame is lit to open the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics. However, according to a recent study, there's some doubt as to how visible the torch will be through the smog. Despite Rio's insistence when lodging its bid that its air quality was within World Health Organization limits, thousands of its citizens die every year from complications associated with going outside and and inhaling. Or, as one University of Sao Paulo pathologist puts it, this is definitely not Olympic air. Quentin, first of all, is this always going to happen when you hold an Olympic Games or any other similar major event outside what we will refer to, without any pejorative sense intended, the first world?
Well, certainly, I think Rio's pollution is a fraction of what it was in Beijing. So let us not forget, I think I've seen a measurement of, it's the NO2 or something, is 88 in Beijing, and it's actually 52 in Rio, and it was 23 in London. And the World Health Organization says it shouldn't be above 20. So it's all not perfect. But I think, I mean, my heart bleeds for Brazil, really. It's an enormous challenge, and I think probably a completely unreasonable challenge to get anybody to try and put a thing like these games together. And the idea that they could transform the air in Rio and the water in, you know, a matter of a couple of years is just being completely unreasonable. And we're going to get all these shock horror stories coming in of unfinished stadiums and everything else. And hey, my heart does bleed because their economy's in a mess and their politics is in a mess.
It is a bit of an Olympic tradition, isn't it, Michael? The sort of the in the weeks before the games, it's always nothing's finished, everything's falling down, you can't breathe the air, it's going to be a catastrophe. And then it usually ends up working out pretty much all right.
Well, the spectacle usually does. In Sydney, Andrew.
Yes, 2000.
Yes.
An unalloyed triumph, obviously.
And the air was perfect, yes?
I wasn't there at the time. Sydney is better than it was in the 1980s and 90s when I lived there.
No, I'm not talking about the pollution. I'm just talking about chaos. The chaos story always goes... I mean, it's part of... And let's talk...
Well, 4 years ago here, it was going to be chaos as
and
well.
And they planned for chaos. And what did they do? There were no tourists in London because everybody had been driven away by... Oh, my God, it's so expensive.
I live two tube stops from where the Olympics were held here in London. I've never seen anything running so smoothly. I was kind of lobbying that London could just hold the Olympics in perpetuity all the time, every day. Everything worked splendidly.
Yeah, and then Boris would never have become Foreign Secretary. He'd just been Secretary of State for the Olympics in perpetuity.
Yeah, I think that would have worked. It just should have gone on and on and on. Everything worked wonderfully well.
It was actually a terrific 2 weeks. You know, look, this is coming on the heels of a World Cup that, you know, it went off. It happened. You know, it would be fine. The thing about the Brazil games is that the one thing that gives me pause that says this will be slightly different is I think Brazil got the games on the back of a single meme, which is Jim O'Neill of Goldman saying there's this concept of the BRICS. You know, these are the emerging market economies.
Brazil, Russia, India, China, South
Africa.
Not
only are they going to overtake America and the European Union, they're going to eat our lunch. And it was around this time when everyone was thoroughly enthused about Brazil coming, you know, into the, becoming the great economic power of Latin America, that they got these games. You know, and it is a big ask because, you know, the reality of the country is that it's probably, you know, its upper levels, its upper echelons may be, you know, comfortable in New York or in London, but the rest of the country is still struggling. I don't know. My guess is that in the end, we all watch the sport, and you said, hold your breath. I mean, can we have the argument now about whether Usain Bolt actually breathes in the 100 meters, or does he just take one enormous breath and go in 9.6, I'm hoping it'll be 9.6 seconds, you know, straight away, and then doesn't breathe again till he gets to the finish line?
On the other hand, they say that for every extra 10 points of particulates in the air, it's 0.2% off the record chance or whatever. So maybe we will get a few fewer records.
I just thought he missed going under 9.5 in Beijing because he was showboating at the end.
It is still one of my favourite moments in sporting history, the fact that he's basically waving to the crowd for the last 20 yards, twirling a parasol and humming a happy tune.
And running. Beijing is almost... What is Beijing? Just a few hundred feet above sea level. So, I mean, there was no thin air there. I mean, it's toxic. I've been to Beijing. And the air is pretty unpleasant. And there he was going 9.58 or 5.2.
I don't think it was that quick. It was fast.
It was under 9.6. That was it. That's why if he hadn't waved, he'd have gone under 9.5.
Well, finally tonight, we must contemplate this ghastly-sounding initiative emanating from Tajikistan, where government officials have announced their intention to start fining journalists who use, and I quote, incomprehensible words. Now, I'm here to tell you, and I have any number of editors who would agree, that I'd go bust pretty quickly if any such regime was instituted here. Quentin, in fairness, this does appear to be an attempt to promote the Tajik language and preserve it from encroachment by Dari and Farsi. So on that basis, is it fair enough? Fining is a bit stiff, isn't it?
The fining does seem to be rather crazy, and if you use more than 10 sort of undefinable words. But the trouble is that Tajik does seem to be awfully close to Farsi and Dari anyway. They're all quite closely related languages. I would have thought it's the Russian words creeping in that they'd find most offensive. But hey, look at what the French have tried to do to prevent French being invaded by Franglais or German by Denglish. Actually, in a computerized age, it just ain't going to work.
I mean, there's a wider question here as well, and it's probably arguments we have all had with editors at various points about the kind of use or otherwise of Rococo language by journalists. Michael, do you have any particular favorite words or phrases that you derive an unusual thrill from getting into print?
No, I've been thinking about this. I guess I was brutally trained, you know, in all the years of, you know, having to argue for an extra 10 seconds for a radio package for National Public Radio, that anytime you got past three syllables, you were in really a lot of trouble. I mean, my big arguments were with my editor saying, don't do a voiceover when I'm interviewing people in Northern Ireland, because that particular accent is incomprehensible, and they and there's a dialect as well. And NPR used to like put a voiceover on top of it. That was my big argument. How about you, Ed?
I have an enormous fondness for arcane phrases for criminals. So I'm always happy to get a ne'er-do-well or a miscreant or a rapscallion into print. That always cheers me up. Ne'er-do-well especially.
Just not merely a recidivist.
Recidivist is also good. I do like a recidivist. I might try and get that in tonight's script for The Daily, in fact, which I am hosting later. What about you, Quentin?
Well, my particular weakness was not for words in the English language, it was actually for names. I love to get in really exotic, weird foreign names into the paper. And my particular joy was when I used to cover the European Parliament, and there were two Italian members of the European Parliament who had my favourite names. One was a lady, I think, called Squarcialupe, and the other was a gentleman called Ciccio Messeri. So they may not have been aware, but every time they said anything about a subject I had the remotest interest in, they got quoted.
This is another arcane field. US politicians, congressmen, there's some excellent names, past and present. I'm always particularly fond of Zach Wamp, Butch Otter, and Dick Sweat, of course, who was a Republican congressman, I believe, from New Hampshire.
And Hillary Clinton's current campaign manager is a guy called Robbie Mook. And anybody who's ever watched Martin Scorsese's Mean Streets knows there's a whole fist fight. Who are you calling a mook? What's a mook? He called me a mook. And then they start fighting each other. So I find that highly amusing.
On that note, we will unfortunately have to leave it. We are all aware, of course, that conversations of this sort among journalists can, and indeed often do, last for hours, but we have but seconds left. Michael Goldfarb and Quentin Peel, thank you very much for joining us. That is all for today's Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sai Villafuerte. Our studio manager was George McDonough. Music next, 1900 Hours, Section D with Josh Fennett and Henry Rhys Sheridan. And as previously plugged, I will be back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Listen out for the gratuitous use of the word recidivist. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.